You know, Joshua Bell's getting a little long in the tooth to be still referred to as a prodigy, but there doesn't seem to be another word to describe him. He's still a young man, but he's been at the top of his game for 25 years. In fact, that's a phrase he wouldn't object to, since before he committed himself to music, Bell was a competitive tennis player, still plays a lot of sports. He's recorded lots of the standard repertoire, as well as film scores, transcriptions of great vocal music, bluegrass, and other American roots music, even a bit of Gershwin. For his latest album, he's teamed up again with John Corigliano. Their earlier recording won both a Grammy Award and an Academy Award. Steve Paulson asked Joshua Bell about the new recording.
Well, you have just put out the album The Red Violin Concerto, which is a follow-up to the film score you did for the movie The Red Violin. What made you interested in this project?
Well, it took on a life of its own. I didn't expect 9 years ago when I was first approached by the director, Francois Girard. He came to a concert of mine and he said he was making a film called The Red Violin and said, "Will you be my voice of my violin for my film?" I mean, that was exciting. And I didn't think it would still be sort of carrying on 9 years later. It was a fantastic project at the time. They brought on board John Corigliano, who was one of my favorite living composers, and to do the score. And of course, then he won the Oscar. And so that was all wonderful. And at the same time, I commissioned him. I really wanted a concert piece, something that would stand outside of the film that I could really play in concert. And he created this chaconne for me back then. And I played that for some years. And then just a couple of years ago, he decided to expand that into a full violin concerto. So there's this Red Violin Concerto, which is inspired by the film, but really it's a serious work on its own and really stands on its own.
So. Mm-hmm. Now, the first movement in this piece is this long chaconne. You tell me about that? What do you find especially intriguing about that piece?
Well, it is unusual to have a chaconne as a first movement, but it really works as the weight of it and the proportions, because it's very evocative. The chaconne includes the big melody of Anna's theme, which is the thing that one might whistle after seeing the film. It's a sort of a haunting melody. And I mean, the chaconne has, of course, as a form, as a history going back, you know, to Bach, the most famous chaconne and most famous violin piece, really taking a small theme or bit of material and sort of repeating it over and over again, but in different permutations. And that, I think, from a composer's standpoint, that's a very creative process. And John Corigliano's done that in such a way that you can listen to this chaconne for 17 minutes and you see how it's changing and you're hearing this theme over, but it doesn't feel repetitive at all, even though that's what a chaconne is. So it's a remarkable composition. And then so I didn't know what to expect, how he would add to that, but he's added these three movements that each have their own distinct personality. The second is this scherzo called Pianissimo, which is just like the most avant-garde of the four movements and really amazing effects. And the third movement is the slow, more traditional slow movement, which again takes some of the movie themes but in a new ways and hints at them. And then the last movement is called accelerando, and it's this fight between violin and orchestra where we're each accelerating at different times and catching up with each other and doing these crunching noises back and forth. It gets really kind of raucous and ends really exciting. And so it's a really satisfying journey, I think, this piece. Mm-hmm. And so I was really happy about it.
Well, tell me about that crunching sound in the last movement. I mean, it's almost like it's such intense playing that you create a certain amount of distortion, which is a very unusual sound to come out of a violin.
Yeah, well, when it's intended, it's good. It's not so nice when it's not intended. It does happen every once in a while, too. But, actually, when Corigliano approached me about it, said, you know, the last one, I want this kind of effect, and can you create this kind of crunching sound, which at first I was hesitant about, or skeptical, I might say. I was hoping it wasn't some sort of gratuitous effect and gimmick. As it turns out, it's really an integral part of the piece and totally is in character with the movement. And when I do it with orchestra, I have to kind of coach them how to do it, because it's not, while it may happen by accident once in a while, to actually create it on cue, the right sort of crunch and distortion so that it doesn't sound just ugly, but it sounds like this guttural crunching sound. We're not trained to do that, so it took a little experimenting to get the right way of playing it. But it's really neat. And in fact, the end of the whole piece ends with this really dramatic long crunch that eventually turns into sort of proper pitch sound, sort of like a distortion on electric guitar, kind of emerging from that distortion. I think it's a really neat end to the piece.
Isn't there a bias in some circles in the classical music world, especially among contemporaries, against, I guess, what we would call romantic music, that it's not intellectual enough?
Well, you can be intellectual and expressive, and Bach showed that perfectly well. I think there was a moment in history, I think it really happened sort of at the beginning of the 20th century, more around World War II, where really I feel that music got overtaken by intellect. It seemed to be thought that it was at odds if it was too beautiful, that it must not be intellectual. And it also came along in the disconnect, I think, between the performers who used to write their own music, and then composers who were out of touch with the ones who were actually performing the piece. But that's my theory on it. I'm sure I'll get yelled at by some musicologists and others who are attracted to certain kinds of music. But I think it's certainly coming much back into character. I think it's being shown in the last, 10, 20 years that composers are daring to actually to be romantic and yet finding ways to do it so it doesn't sound cliche and derivative and like been there, done that. I'm happy that that's being accepted. I mean, even a piece like the Barber Violin Concerto was written around the time that, the Schoenberg and these other composers were writing very avant-garde music and atonal music, and Barber is the sweet, beautiful piece that I think really wasn't taken that seriously because of that. And now it's become one of the standard violin concertos, and I play it all the time, and many violinists play the Barber, and it's just a gorgeous piece. And I'm happy that that piece is, that's an example of how we've changed our views.
Mm-hmm. Now, you play a Stradivarius, and from all that I've heard, it's an exceptional, one-of-a-kind violin. In fact, didn't you once have another Stradivarius, and you sold it so you could get this one?
Well, I did, and the other one is an exceptional one-of-a-kind, too. They're like people. Each instrument is unique and has its own character, and when I gave up the other one, it was not easy, except I had fallen in love with this other one. So it's a bit like a divorce and a remarriage.
It's that different? I mean, playing with these two different violins?
Oh, yes. I mean, to an audience member, maybe to some people, they might say, I don't hear that much of a difference. But for me, for the player and what you can do with it and the way it responds to you, it feels like each one, just has a different world of color and things that you can do with it. And after 8 years of playing on the other one, which I loved, I just happened to see this one in London and try it. And within a minute, I fell in love with it and said, I have to have it. And I found a way to arrange the switch. But who's to say whether that might not happen again with another instrument in a few years? It could happen, but
has this changed your style of playing, having this particular violin? And do you play in a different way?
Yeah, absolutely, in subtle ways. But it allows me certain colors and things that I might not have been able to access with the other violin. Although it may be missing some things as well. But this violin is a bit more brilliant, and it allows me to, when I play with an orchestra, I feel I can. I don't have to worry so much about projecting over the orchestra, so I can worry about other things and feel like the sound is going to float above the orchestra. And I find this violin is very well balanced between the low end and the top end. And it's sort of like a painter being given a different set of colors. I mean, they're still the same artist, but they can now go in slightly different directions. So it makes all the difference having a great instrument. I mean, it's the depth of sound and the complexity of the sound. It just inspires the player, and so it helps in that way.
Now, is it just that, I mean, a violin that's made today, I mean, no matter how masterfully made, is that just going to have a totally different sound than a 300-year-old Stradivarius?
Well, yes, although there are some really remarkable violin makers today, and one of them, Sam Zygmuntowicz, who lives in Brooklyn, who I take my Strad to as well on occasion to have him look at it, he's made me a violin that really I would feel comfortable playing in concert and feel confident. It's very hard to tell the difference with a few of the makers out there today really creating great things. There's still something about the old sound that maybe it just takes some years of mellowing that, you know, like a wine, you know, there's an age factor or something that gives a certain shimmer and depth that I think the age brings along. But there are some great new makers, absolutely, and the price difference is huge. Sometimes you're paying a huge price for just that 5 to 10% difference. But in a sense, in all things great, it's that top 5% that makes all the difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I'm always curious about is when people first realize what their true vocation is. And I guess I wonder about you, because I know you started playing at a very early age. And did you know, let's say when you were 10 years old, that you were going to become a concert violinist?
Well, yeah, I think I definitely knew before I knew what the word vocation meant. I think I knew what I was going to do. I'd say it was probably around the age 12 that really, when I met my teacher, Joseph Gingold, and he sort of took music to another level for me, the magic of it really started to affect me in a way that I thought, boy, I could really make this my life. And I started getting encouragement, too, that I could do it for a living, because that was what a great thought, you know, to actually make a living, not to ever have to get a real job. of course, there's a lot of work involved, but if it's something you love, it's a great way to make a living. So, yeah, I'd say it was about around the age 12 where I really started to think this is going to be my life.
But I also heard that as I was reading up about you, I mean, you were quite a serious tennis player as a kid as well, right?
I was a competitive tennis player. You know, I was pretty good at it and did pretty well in some tournaments and things. But I mean, certainly there's no way I could have ever been a professional tennis player. So that was not ever in question. But I would, you know, there are other things I might have thought of going into. I mean, I loved science and there are other directions I would have gone. Tennis wouldn't have been one of them, but I still play a lot of sports, basketball, tennis, and golf. But music was really such a clear choice for me that I think there's no going back now. Even if I can't play the violin anymore, I think I'm pretty much in this profession, whether it's teaching or conducting or composing. There's so many ways to be, you know, a musician. For me, it's my life, and yeah, definitely no going back.
Joshua Bell talked with Steve Paulson.